Wait, wait, stop, that's the one.
Welcome to Zenten Speaks, a show where I make new friends and reconnect with old ones. A show where everyone's stories may inspire you to tell your own story. In this podcast, we encourage everyone to get rid of shame, guilt, fear, doubt, and judgments for themselves and for others, and replace those with love, empathy, compassion, understanding, kindness, and to do your best in everything that you do. In essence, to get rid of things that no longer serve your well-being. To be true to yourself and be honest with others. No need to be politically correct. That's out the window with 2020. Here, we tell the raw, uncensored story. Your story. And tell the truth as you see it. Make sure you live your fulfilled life without permission or apologies. So, if you have a juicy, interesting, raw, unapologetic story, and inspiring, please make sure to contact me at zenten21@gmail.com. It is zenten21@gmail.com. Or you can find me on most social media platforms. You know it, the IG, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, OnlyFans. I mean, not really, but yes, OnlyFans. Just kidding. Not. As you may guessed it, my name is Zen, and welcome to the show. Today we have a guest. Our guest today is Kelly McKen. Kelly and I met on one of those sober Facebook groups. And Kelly had recently celebrated his 26th year of being sober. So he told me his story of failed career, failed marriages, and his battling with bipolar disorder. So welcome, Kelly, to the show.
Hey, thank you very much, Zen.
Yeah, thank you for your time and being here. You're welcome. So tell us about who you are and what brings you joy.
Well, what brings me joy? I'm Kelly McKen. I live in North Central Montana, which is in the middle of nowhere. Actually, that's misleading. One town over is technically the middle of nowhere. So we're that close. If you look up Glasgow, Montana, you'll see they've done a study that it's the middle of nowhere. And I moved here for a couple of very specific reasons. One is mental health issues. I built and sold a successful computer firm and went back to working with kids, which is what makes me happy. I started out my career kind of after sobriety as a teacher, went into the computer field, and then built the company, sold it, packed up everything I had, moved to this little town to work with kids. The main reason being it's good for my mental health because it is very, very slow and very, very low stress here.
Mm. Nice. Yeah. I think most people, if not all people, need very slow and low stress, because I, even at work, I do, part of the work that I do is catering. And when I got into the industry, people were saying, oh, this is how it is. It's stress and it's hustle bustle, is throwing dishes around and yelling and cussing. And then at the end of the night, it's kumbaya, everyone's happy. But while they were at work, they were killing each other, not literally. But I was just like, no, it's a choice. You don't need to be stressing about this. And so when I got in the industry, they would call me slow. They would thought I didn't want to be part of it. But I've been there for like 7 years now, because I refuse to play the game of like running around like a cockroach or like a chicken without the head, being all stressed out. So I totally love that. Actually, I think Montana is one of the states I would love to visit because of the view and from what I hear from it. And it looks very beautiful because I love nature. Uh-huh. And so I'm in New York City and I'm from Boston, like big cities. Yeah. I'm totally done with the, I guess as you get older, you don't care for party life anymore. So I'm just, Yeah, those days are over. Yeah. So tell us about the shame, guilt, and fear that maybe you currently have or you had had in the past and how you have overcome it, or if you still have those and how you're working to overcome them. Your shame, fear, and guilt.
Shame, guilt, and fear?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you look at the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the 12-step program to which I subscribe, when you get into what they call the fourth step, if you're familiar with 12 steps, take a fearless and thorough moral inventory of yourself. That's a real hard one because that's where you have to hold the mirror up and you have to look in it. And what stares back at you oftentimes is not something that you want to see.
Mm-hmm.
What they encourage when you do a fourth and fifth step is to look at what your guilts, your fears. What was the other one you said? Guilts, fears?
Guilt. Yeah. So basically shame, guilt, and fear.
Shame, guilt, fear. All of that is encouraged to be included in the fourth step. Things that you resent, because oftentimes when you look at what you resent, it presents itself as all three of those things, your guilt, your shame, and your fear. So I have in my time in sobriety done a number of fifth steps, which is you do the fourth step, the fearless and searching moral inventory. And then in the fifth step, you admit to God, yourself, and another human being the exact nature of your wrongs. Which means you actually have the accountability of another person. I would sit down with Zen and I'd say, you know, I cheated on my wife. I killed somebody and don't tell anybody that kind of thing. You know, that's a joke, by the way. I've never killed anybody. that was how I have, however, been unfaithful. Unfortunately, and that is something I'm guilty about. I was unfaithful on my last wife and rest her soul. Unfortunately, she was killed in a terrible motorcycle accident a couple of years ago. But we worked past that and we were able to be friends. Guilt in the past, being someone who suffers not only with addictive issues, but also with pretty severe mental health issues, including bipolar disorder, major anxiety disorder, depressive disorder, ADHD, you pretty much stack it on, and I have suffered from it to some degree. And even sober and even practicing all those principles of the 12 steps in all of my affairs, I still have not been an easy person to be with. And it's only been in the past few years that all of my children are talking to me at the same time because they have all had to work through trauma. I have been married three times, divorced twice, all in sobriety. I didn't lose a job until I was in sobriety. And so the guilt and the shame that goes along with being unpredictable, angry, and you're probably familiar with bipolar disorder to some degree. It doesn't always present itself as manic euphoria. Oftentimes, in my particular disorder, we'll have what they call a mixed state where I'm up and down at the same time. And it's like having a tsunami in my brain and you can't stop it. And when that happens, you know, your children, your wife, whoever, can never anticipate who's going to walk in the door. And some days I might be fine. And some days I might walk in and throw a dish across the room. Fortunately, I have been under effective medical help over the past decade or so. So I haven't had a lot of those issues anymore. My current wife has never seen that guy or very little of him. Whereas in my previous life, my previous wife's and all three of my biological children and my stepchildren all unfortunately got to see that guy. And that, those things, and it's not just my family, it has cost me dearly in every avenue of my life. Mental illness has cost me careers, friendships, relationships, any kind of intimacy with people. I have destroyed some at some point because of my mental health issue. All those factors bring me guilt, shame, and fear. When is the monster going to come back? I don't know. And it terrifies me that he will. You know what I mean? what am I guilty about? The things that I have done that hurt other people. And I'm ashamed of all that. And, you know, if you deal with mental health issues, you can't help it. You know, I always say Zen, crazy people don't know they're crazy. Sane people who are acting crazy know it. It's just situational. But crazy, like, and when you're mentally ill, you don't really know you're there until you have a toolbox that exposes to you, you know, the signs and symptoms and triggers that put you in that place. And fortunately, I have worked very hard the past decade or so after I was diagnosed with these issues. And I have gotten to get past a lot of that.
Wow. Wow. That must be, I never experienced things like that before. And that must be very challenging. And especially you're aware of it now and then you're saying it. And that 12 step, I've never gone to those 12 steps. I've gone to other kind of addictions, but not alcohol or NA kind of things. So, but I heard of those steps. And so I think those steps, anyone else can also use them.
Oh, yeah.
Because I see the transformation, someone who's gone through it, like you and other people, how their life is so much better because they've gone through it. They look in the mirror and they ask those questions and they went through those steps. And I'm like, why can't normal people do it? Because a lot of people are walking around and they need those steps in their lives. And, you know, funny thing is, I think if you have a resource for me, like let's say a website, whatever, I would love to actually go, because I never read all of them at once, but at interviewing enough people, now I'm very intrigued. I would love to actually read them and see if I can do them in my life to see how I can improve, because that's the point of being alive, improvement and growth.
Always, always.
Yeah.
I had a friend in the program. I haven't seen him in a long time. He passed away, unfortunately. He was sober before I was born, and I didn't meet him until I was sober, probably 5 years, maybe 3 or 4 years. And I walked into this meeting. His name was Perry. And I looked at this guy, and this is one thing I learned right away is don't judge a book by its cover. I thought, my God, where did they dig this guy up at? And they just roll him out of the gutter and bring him into the meeting. But as soon as he started to talk, it was evident that this was a man who had been practicing the spiritual aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous for a very long time. And at that point, he'd been sober for 40 years. One of the things Perry said to me, that he said actually meetings, he didn't just say it to me, he said, you know, the 12 steps are nothing but a Christian way of living. And that's always stuck with me, because all of those principles that are espoused by all of the great religious leaders are encompassed by what we do in the 12 steps. Amends, confession, character. I'm looking at a couple others you might have. Improving a constant contact with God as we understand him. Admitting our powerlessness. Taking inventory of ourselves. Make direct amends. Continue to take personal inventory. And when we're wrong, promptly admit it. All of those things are just good value.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And my current wife, Magnolia, you'd love her. She's an interesting lady. We were talking about spirituality, and she's a very devout Christian, and I'm not particularly a devout Christian. And she said, but you have your 12 steps as my road to spirituality, you know, and the first step is, second step, excuse me, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And three is made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood him, in italics in the book, as we understood him. And so what Perry would say is, it's just a Christian way of living. And he's absolutely right. And with that comes the growth, steady growth. Program tells us we seek spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection, because nobody can be a perfect person. So anyway, that's where I was going with Perry. He passed away, unfortunately, some time ago, but obviously a gentleman who had a huge impact on me in a number of different ways.
Right. And with the Christian part, I grew up Jehovah's Witness, and that was about 20 years ago. But I'm still on the groups, you know, on Facebook, there's different groups, and there's groups about Jehovah's Witness. And I've noticed and I cannot claim to know people's experiences, of course. And a lot of them had gone through a lot of bad stuff in their lives. And I did not, but I still joined to see and all this stuff. So I like to call myself a scientist because I like to experiment and study people and things, but I don't have any degree in it. I just like interest. So I've noticed like with people, how they behave because they leave Jehovah's Witness or they got kicked out. They dismiss everything they learned. And it's okay, it's their lives, but then they complain about certain things in life. And so I cannot help to question like, well, you know, you did not have to reject A, B, C, and D, because although you learned it in a religion, it's about life. It's not really a religion thing. Like one of the 12 steps, as you mentioned, I didn't know about is when you do wrong, you admit it. It's like values. It's like you don't need to reject it because the religion taught you that, and then you're going to have to find out yourself. Right. So anything that's practical in my life or find relevancy, I still practice in my life, and I don't get into trouble because I see it and I'm like, those are good guidances for me to live. And I'm not religious either. I'm more spiritual. So I just live my life and I don't get into trouble because it's all about choices.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and part of like, if you do wrong, to admit it, I learned it from inspirational speakers, because I love reading books all the time, and like audiobooks, they're like easier to listen to. So I can listen to like 2 or 3 a week kind of a thing. So I, Wayne Dyer and like many other people. And so I take those principles and I apply them to my life because I feel like as I'm doing them, it's like, it's so much better. My life is like improving as a normal person, whatever. So those 12 steps, definitely, I'm going to look more into them because now I'm like intrigued. And I think based on what I'm hearing, a lot of people that I interview, it's a big life changer for them. So why can it not be for other people who's never gone through addiction, et cetera? So a question I have for you with the, so you've gone to like 26 years, like, is this something, because I've noticed in those groups, people often count, they're like, hey, my 14th day or my 15th day. I'm curious, like, why is that important to count days? Like you on your 26 years, like you've done that like for 26 year and every day, like, why is that important? I'm curious about that.
I'm looking at my sobriety calculator right here.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of them online. Okay, so I technically have 2 sober dates. My last drink was December 10, 1994. However, I was still popping pills and smoking weed up until the 1st of April, 1995. And I checked into rehab on April 4, 1995, which I consider my true sober birthday.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew that day I was sober. I didn't, you know. So, yes, and I'll just turn 27 years on April 4th will be my. So let's count from 1995. So 04, 04, 05. You didn't even deal minutes on this one. So I have 9,757 days right now. One day at a time. It is always one day at a time.
Yeah.
Keep it simple. Don't complicate it. One foot in front of the other. And I remember coming out of rehab. My wife was pregnant with who's now, you know, my oldest child. I was completely ineffective. I could not work. I had failed out of nursing school. I'd gone back to school. I was going to become a nurse. I'd failed out of nursing school. I couldn't work. I was high all the time. When I wasn't high, I was just depressed and slept. And I walked out of rehab, you know, my legs still kind of shaking. What am I going to do now? You know, when I speak in AA, I always say, what the F am I going to do now? It's kind of a pattern in my life. What the F am I going to do now? And so I said that, what am I going to do now? Well, I went out and got a job, you know, and worked on my marriage, got my marriage together, had the little boy. He's now, you know, 25, will be 26. Every one of those was done sometimes a minute at a time. Sometimes I had to pray every minute just to get me by, every 10 minutes. Sometimes I'd pray every hour. After a while, I started noticing, I've had a few days in a row now, you know, 60, 10, 50, 60, 100. Then all of a sudden I realized, wow, I've been sober for 5 years, then 10 years, then 12 years was as long as I was drinking. So then I was sober longer than I was drinking. And then, you know, then you get 15 years is cool and 20 years is cool. Then I went, I have been sober half my life now. You know, all these hallmarks that you meet as you go along. And another thing I do, everywhere I go is my coin. This one actually says 25. There's a story. My stepson just graduated a program called Montana Youth Challenge. It helps them get their high school diploma and whatnot. And I give all my kids my coin from the year they were born. And my stepson wants me to adopt him. So he got this year's coin I gave to him when he graduated, along with one. He wanted one of my military dog tags that he could put on his keychain. I have a couple of them still. So I gave him one of those and I gave him my coin. Mm-hmm. I carry this everywhere I go, Zen, as a constant reminder that, okay. And I've got a stack of them. It's about that tall now, but there's 26 of them in there.
Yeah.
You know, my son has most of them. So anyway, one day at a time, sometimes 1 minute at a time, every one of those days adds up to the totality of what my sobriety is. And what my sobriety is the totality of who I am. And it's integral to what I am as a functioning human being. Mm-hmm. The 12 steps are integral to who I am as a person.
So let's say year 25, is this something you still constantly thinking about? Let's say your day one, I'm guessing, or day one between day seven, you probably were like, oh, here's a drink, or, oh, don't look at that, or don't smell it. Or you're like ducking down like ads and people are doing it. How's your life process now? Is this something you actually think about now? Or is it so much second nature that it's not even a thing for you anymore? You don't even think about it because it doesn't matter in your life anymore. Right. I'm curious about that.
You know, it's interesting because I don't know if I shared with you in our correspondence. I've also been a professional musician most of my life. I spent my first three AA birthdays in a bar. Mm. It is not something I think about anymore. And I'll tell you, it's a different for some guys. Like you'll see in the sobriety groups that we're in, I mean, these people are really jonesing for a drink, you know, or some meth or whatever they're into. They're really struggling with it. But one thing I've noticed with me and some of my people who have maintained long-term sobriety, by the time we were ready to quit, turned our will and our lives over to the care of God, the craving of alcohol and drugs was removed. So, and by the time I went to rehab, I was so ready to do anything, not to do that anymore, that I was ready to take any steps. And I have a little bit at first, maybe cravings here and there, but then they all went away. But then what happened is you start getting what they call drunk dreams, where you dream about drinking.
Yeah, I've seen some posts about that.
Yeah. Mine were always, I would go, and I don't know if you know, those beer glasses are kind of shaped like that, you know, in a corner bar kind of place. I always dreamed I'd order one of those and take a drink out of it and ruin my sobriety and not even have any fun. Those were my dreams. And I haven't even had one of those in years.
They sound like nightmares.
They kind of are. You wake up and you know that few seconds before you realize it was just a dream. Like, oh my God, I just lost all my sobriety. And oh, it's just a dream. No, I don't crave alcohol at all. First 3 years I was sober, I bet I didn't walk down the beer aisle in the grocery store. I'm also what I refer to as a rigorist. If I know food is cooked with alcohol, I won't order the food. And I understand the physics of it. I understand the science. That doesn't matter. It has to work here.
Yeah.
I don't buy Jack Daniel's brand sunflower seeds or barbecue sauce. You know what I mean? I have only on rare occasion purchased alcohol for any reason. And it's always been some odd circumstance. I traded an instrument repair to a guy for a 32 pack of Miller Lite or something. He fixed a trombone for me. It was one of those things. So, and as far as the painkiller thing, when you're an addict and a rigorist, I mean, I will take ibuprofen. I will take non-narcotic anti-inflammatories. I've had severe physical injuries. I've broken my neck. I had a lazy eye growing up, if you're familiar with that. Once had all these muscles cut off and sewed back on. Felt like they dug my eye out with a fork. Tylenol. Because I won't take narcotics. Mm-hmm. And it's in a medical order in my medical records, no narcotics until in stage, whatever, you know, and that's the rigorous in me. And it makes it easy when you do that. It makes it easy not to think about alcohol. The other part of it is thinking about living all the time. You know what I mean? Practicing the principles and up 12 steps in all of my affairs. So no, I don't get cravings. And that burden was lifted from me very early in sobriety. I don't like being around a lot of drinking, mainly because as soon as people start getting drunk, they start slurring and meaningful conversation disappears anyway. So I just go home and watch Star Trek or something, you know. See you later, guys. Time for me to leave. That's you know, a blessing in yeah. so many ways.
How's your relationship with people when you don't hang out with them in their activities? Do you get judged or people, or do you have to tell your story in order to understand? Because I've noticed, because I've been sober, not straight edge, all my life. And not until last year, I went through some peer pressure and bad company kind of a thing. And I did certain stuff in 2020. And then, but beforehand, I had a rule for myself. If you have more than one drink when we're hanging out, you only allow one drink. And or not doing other things, not even smoking around me anymore, because I used to be okay with smokers, but then I come home smelling like cigarettes or weed, but I wasn't even doing any of this stuff. So I just made the rules for myself. But then I've noticed, like, it's kind of like, it was good for me because of my integrity, but it was bad because then I had rules for other people and people don't feel good about those things. So when I would meet anyone new or people that were in my life, I would say, you can do those things. When you start doing them, it's time for me to leave. So that way I'm not controlling you. You're doing your stuff. You don't need to feel like, hey, I'm craving a cigarette, but I'm hanging out with him and I can't, you know, it. So I got rid of that. But then people felt they felt being judged. If I say I don't drink, people feel being judged. If I say I don't smoke, they feel being judged, or they would peer pressure me and call me like all sorts of name, you know, to like you're in high school, hey, smoke this or whatever. And then it would make the relationship funny. So I didn't know what else to do because I tried different things. Like I said, I like to be a scientist to like try different things. And now I'm in a space where if I know you do substance, I won't friend you, period. Mm-hmm. Because I don't want to go back into the argument of like someone either pre-pressure me or shaming me for not doing it, or they feel judged because people usually say, it's my third glass, don't judge me. And I'm like, I didn't say anything. Like, you're judging yourself by saying it out already. Don't judge me. Like, I'm just looking. So, and I've noticed some people just assumed I was an addict. So when I say I don't drink, they're like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Like, so they make all this story. So I let them believe that because I was easier for them to believe that I was that. And then for them to put that away, for me to say, no, I'm just straight edge, because for some reason people get offended by someone who just decide to not do those things, who never went through an addict. Yeah, I don't get it. Like, it's interesting to me. So how's your relationships? Do everyone you meet, you have to tell them that's your story, or?
Well, the two parts to that question. How do I deal with being out there and my relationships? After I was sober probably 5 years, I make no bones about the fact that I'm sober. You know, I carry my coin. I've got a tattoo on my arm that says, you know, it's got the AA triangle. Anybody that asks, hey, you know, do you do this? No, I don't drink. I've been sober since 1994. And almost everyone's like, oh my God, that's great. Good for you. You must be so proud, which incidentally, whenever I hear that, I laugh because Yeah, I'm so proud of this. You know, I aspired to this. When I was about 14, I thought, I'm going to go be an alcoholic when I grow up. No, I'm not proud of it. It is just what I am, you know? So I make no bones about it. And by sharing that fairly freely, I have had people come to me many, many times and come into recovery as a result of knowing me, you know? And I was able to share that 12 steps with them. And the second thing is, what happens with my social life? I haven't had anybody give me a hard time about drinking except one time, and it was very early in my drinking. And the lady, she knew I was newly sober, and her husband said, "What, are you too good to have a beer with me?" You know, and she smacked him. And I at that point, I didn't know how to handle it. Now mm-hmm. I say, "Well, no, yeah, shut up, I'm leaving." You know. When people say, "Oh, I don't want to make you uncomfortable," I tell them, Zen, I say, that is kind of insulting to me because my sobriety has nothing to do with you, nothing whatsoever to do with you. Do what you want and you'll have a ride home because I will be sober. Mm. But don't let my sobriety in any way affect how you are going to behave. And I've had to use that one a lot. People don't invite me places. They know if there's going to be a lot of drinking, I probably won't be comfortable. I would like to make that decision more than them, but they often make it for me, and I'm just not invited to certain places. They know oftentimes I'll leave. Time to go. Love you guys. Bye. My first wife quit drinking when I did, and my second wife was a casual drinker. She's from New York. She is from New York too, Long Island. So I've been back there a number of times with her, rest her soul. She would drink now and then. And sometimes I'd take her out and buy her a drink because just to relax, you know, she needed to relax. My current wife, Magnolia, she did not drink for quite some time while we were together. She's a great codependent. We're perfect for each other. But now she's comfortable, you know, having a cocktail now and then. And you drink, she drinks, it has nothing to do with me. Nothing whatsoever. That's how I look at it. Does it bother me? Nope. People do. It's none of my business. If you drink, it's none of my business. The program teaches us that. I keep my half of the street clean, man. Your half is yours. It's none of my business what you do. You know right. what I mean? And I live by that. And I don't judge anybody. Now, I see people that I think, maybe they've got a little bit of a problem. I've seen a lot of that over the years, especially playing in a band. You know, you see the same people that enjoy your music come out not time after time. When you see the same person time after time completely obliterated by alcohol, yeah. there's a pattern of behavior that is pretty indicative of a problem, even if they're not an alcoholic, you know. So anyway, that's getting off track. I do not have a problem being a non-drinker in a drinking world. And that's yeah. how I deal with it.
I have a friend, actually. I know many people in the spectrum, some people who are still doing their thing, but they deny it. And some people who've gone back and forth and whatever, but I have this friend who's been sober for a long time, but it's weird and funny. I've noticed, like, since I don't drink and I don't do these things, for some reason, like, I make jokes about them or we're friends. Like, I make like reference to them a lot when I'm around him. So I'm kind of thinking, because I had to think about it, because I like to be mindful and self-aware. And I was like, why am I often making jokes and making reference to alcohol? Because that's not a thing that I don't indulge in those things. And why am I all of a sudden when I'm around him, I'm doing it? So I had to, the answer I've got is, it's kind of like when your mom or your parents says you cannot do something, just because they say you can't do it, for some reason, your mind is on there for you to do it, even if it has no interest for you.
Sure.
And I would send him like a meme of someone smoking whatever, or someone like, especially in catering, there's a lot of jokes about Coke. And I'm sure some people do it, but I get in those jokes too. I think it's funny, but it's not something I can't wait to go home and do. And so, yeah. And then I will send him that meme and but I think he gets triggered, definitely. So I had to learn if I see anything substance now, like in the past, I was like very, like I would be that person, like I need to really think of what I need to do before I do it. And so, because I would make that mistakes a couple times, even more than three times, to actually get it and be like, no, that person gets triggered. So don't mention anything. And if I slip, I would immediately apologize and try to delete the message and like gravel, because I understand like it's a very big trigger for him. And so I had to, it was tough because I was like, I never experienced that before. But now I think what it helped me do is to have empathy and very mindful of what I say and the jokes that I make around certain people about certain things. So in the beginning, it was not good because I was just like, oh my God, I'm limiting to live. But now I'm like, oh, and it's good because one needs to be mindful of what you say, because how people perceive it, it's like, you know, they have their emotions and stuff that could trigger them, like trauma. I did not understand, like, call me crazy, I did not understand trauma until last year, until I went through my own. You know, like they say, you don't know the road until you walk it yourself. I've heard of these things. I heard of the concept, but not until mine got brought up. And I was like, damn. And that's when I met somebody and we got indulged with crazy stuff. And I went to a low point of my life. And I was like, what the hell is all this? So for 10 months, I went through a space of rediscovery of myself and found some trauma there. Like, interesting stuff.
Yeah. I'll tell you a story about called putting your foot in your mouth, right? I'm a huge Beatles fan, okay? Decorate my offices.
Oh, you know? I love Beatles too, yes.
My license plate said, Obladi. The other car is Oblada. Obladi, Oblada, right? You like this raw and naked, right? I'm going to cuss a little.
Yeah, totally.
As we learn, I played a lot of theater. I played in bands and theaters all over the place. And I've done that for 20-something years. And when you're in the theater business, there's a lot of LGBTQ kind of, you know, that's kind of a place that they work in. And I'm in this band, and the keyboard player, Timber, he's gay. And the guitar player was a young guy, and he says to me, Kelly, what does Obladi mean? I said, you got to be shitting me, you.
Oh, I mean, he didn't know Beatles.
It just came out. And yeah, he didn't know the Beatles. And I saw Timber go, you know, and I went, oh, God. I go, Timber, are you gay? He says, yes, I am. I said, I am so sorry, because I'm going to let you slide. I said, you know, if I would have called him an idiot, and there's a special needs guy in the room, it just came out. He goes, oh, I know, you know. But why that? Why then? You know? The foot in the mouth. So yeah, I learned really quick to watch what I say. Now, you got to be shitting me, you dweeb, whatever, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what came out. Anyway, that was a story that ties in with what you just said. I thought, yeah, you know, sometimes you got to learn social grace. And social grace is something too that has come not only with maturity, professionalism, with education, and with the program. I mean, I grew up in a trailer court with a disabled father. They write songs about where I came from. So the fact that I was educated, I went to college, I have a master's degree, I worked really hard to get where I'm at. I understand the other side of it. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
I'm not saying we were white trash, but we were white trash. My father was a very brilliant man. He was a commercial pilot. He suffered a stroke when he was very young, left our family destitute. But I did not learn social grace from my family. I learned that vicariously by living through life, by interactions, by learning the hard way what to ask and what not to ask, what to say and what not to say, and more importantly, when to keep my mouth shut and when to keep it open.
Yeah, you know? It's also good timing too. I feel like it's okay to say or ask certain things, but you need to have good timing. And people have often told me, who met me, like the minute they meet me, I make them relax so much, as if they're on drugs, they can say whatever they want. And I recognize that in myself, because they feel like, I feel calm around you, and I feel like you're my friend, and I can say all these things. And I don't take offense to things, because I see people differently. However, I'll tell them, I was like, that's great. You open up to me. People have opened up to me that they were skinhead Nazis.
Oh yeah.
Let's go this deep. Okay. So, but I tell them, I was just like, and then they'll tell me other times where they slip. And I'm like, yeah, it's good to mind your tongue and mouth because there's the right people to talk to. There's a right time. And sometimes people tell me terrible stuff. And I do feel a certain way. But since I understand people, I'm like, okay, it's because they say those things or they feel so comfortable because I know who I am. And I choose to be that person where someone like, because when I grew up Jehovah's Witness, I took things very seriously. And when Jesus says, be the comfort, like have someone come to your bosom and like be that comfort for them. So I put that as my personality, as me. And so now I understand why people, once they meet me, and then especially when they're hurt, they like, oh, and they want to say everything and put down their lies, whatever. So I get that. But another thing I've learned through me and through those people, and then they would tell me, they're like, wow, how could you not judge me? How could you not like basically bash my teeth in right now? And then I was like, why would you ask that question? I was perplexed, but now I get why they ask it, because they wouldn't not get that from most people of the world.
Right.
And one thing I learned, and I was just like, oh, wouldn't it be so nice if people are more understanding or accepting of others? It's like, there's a difference if someone come at you, they want to hurt you and they saying slurs. And it's a difference someone either slip or they confide in you and they're telling you their darkest secret.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, there's a difference. And I feel like each party, like the recipient or the person who just need to mind their tongue and to whoever, needs to learn, like discern right time, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, the common thing is a lot of these people, they feel so relieved and thankful that I'm not like either emotionally or physically violent toward them. And they're like, whoa, who are you? Like, how can I tell you these things? Like this other guy was telling me how that's like a thing I'm going to have in my solo podcast. He was telling me how he goes to BLM protests and he's very leftist and pro Black Lives Matter and all this stuff. But then he would target especially Black women because they trust a white man who's walking around or behind them. And then he would mug them.
Oh.
And he feels very shame about it because there you go, you're at a protest, you're an ally, but then at night you're differently. And he was telling me like truthfully how he's conflicted. Like, is he a bad person? And that leads him to do drugs and beating himself up and and talking about it, like, whew, I'm like hearing and feeling the conversation. And I used to be one of those people, like when people would dump their lies onto me, I used to take it. What's that word? There's a word they call like an empath. Now I learned to like hear you and then it stays there because I cannot take it anymore. Cause I used to take people's energies and feelings and it all becomes mine and I become physically sick by it. And that's why I believe in energy and spirituality because I experience it. Now I'm like, okay, can you tell me your stuff? I cannot fix it for you. I can hear you out, but, and so I accept those people as human beings who's going through some turmoil. I hear them, I value them. And like, I cannot be Jesus for them. Like, I don't want to be either, but I thought at that moment, I was able to give them what they were looking for that moment. And maybe it will change their lives forever, maybe not, whatever. But people have come to me like strangers, tell me the craziest shit. And I'm like, And I think because I accept their story and not make them as a villain or a bad person, because I don't believe any of us, even the people who's done the crazy, heinous things, hurt people. And if most people would stop to listen to your story to see why you say certain things and why something comes out of your mouth, falls out, to understand why, then people will be more likely to be themselves and not go home and beat themselves up. Yeah, anyway, that's my spiel about that. Because I feel you where you're coming from. And I had to change my language. even around the LGBT, I had to like, especially now, things are changing every year and every month. I have to like change my language or mind my language. Now, what I do is I do my best to like not say anything because anything offends anybody or whatever. When it comes to a conversation or if I feel someone is fired about something, I just don't have an input. Because I was like, I don't really need to. And if I do, that's like ego. On my platform, I say whatever I want. Sure. But if someone's saying, hey, da da da, I'm like, okay, that's your story. I don't need to say, because I might say something that offends because I think differently. Yeah.
Yeah, I get it. That's funny you brought that up. One of the things, you know, pardon me, in addition to everything else, I'm the adult child of an alcoholic. You know, I grew up in an alcoholic home. I'm the fourth of four children, so I fit that mold. You know, whenever you look up what's the alcoholic family look like, there's roles, defined roles. And as the youngest, I had my defined roles. And one of those things was I'm intensely empathic. In addition to being hideously codependent myself, I absorb feelings and I have the ability to determine other people's feelings. And like you, I get part of it I've worked out, and part of it is just inherently how I am, my bearing, my countenance. I get people to open up to me as well. And in some ways I've worked at it. I'll give you an example. I was dating this lady. This is not even 10 years ago. This was in the past, maybe 2013. And we're at the park. And she happened to be talking about, you know, you just have a way of getting people to open up to you, you know. And I said, watch this. The cop had showed up at the park to do his, you know, look at the park and said, watch this. By the time we were done, I knew where the cop lived. I knew his kids' names. I knew where they went to school. And she goes, how do you do that? And I said, practice. And he also gets the feeling I'm not going to hurt him. Mm-hmm. You know, and yeah. In my case, I'm not a sociopath, so I act that way and it's genuine. You know, sociopaths, yeah. They can act that way and you believe them, but he trusted me, you know, and I've worked really hard at working with difficult people too. You know, I've kept difficult people in my life just for that reason, to learn how to deal with difficult people.
But oh my God, me too.
Yeah, I've had computer clients and I mean, talk about a pain in the ass, batshit crazy people. But I keep them because if I can work with them, I can work with anybody. And it's really helped. And the other part of being non-judgmental, again, it all goes back to the program. I heard a young guy at a meeting one time. It wasn't that long ago. He said, you know, he's all angry. He's brand new sober. He's angry. He says, you know, so many people have hurt me. There's going to be a reckoning on these people for hurting me. And I listened to him. Came my time to talk, I said, you know, I was busy worrying about a reckoning when I had to worry about my own and the reckoning that came to me for the damage that I had done to others. Mm. And this kid's face just went, it hadn't occurred to him. Yeah, it's my side of the street, man. The reckoning was the amends I had to make.
Mm-hmm.
Running into Sherry Shimamoto, I dated her for 2 years in college, right? Broke up. I walk into the mall. They had a calendar display in the mall. You know, she's now like the blood splatter analyst for the Denver police, you know, like Dexter. But at the time, she's working at the calendar booth in the mall. And I turn around the corner and she goes, hi, can I help you? I could have gone 50 years without seeing your face. Sherry, I am so sorry I hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've gotten sober. I don't drink anymore. And I was not good to you. And I apologize. And I don't know what else I can say. You know, that was where an amend was right in my face. I had no choice but to apologize to her. It was an amend I had to make. And she presented the opportunity. And she let me know exactly how long she could go without seeing my face. More power to her, you know. But I kept my side of the street clean.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot where I was going with that. Anyway, what's next?
Yeah. Well, ties into, I wanted to ask you, do you think the way your childhood was ties to the addiction you had? And leading question is, how was your childhood? Tell us about that.
I did tons of trauma in my childhood. Just last week when I was going down to pick up my stepson, I stopped and saw my sister. I had 3D printed these two Grinch dolls for her because she likes the Grinch. She's a teacher as well. And we talked briefly about how much we hate the holidays. And we both just, I hate the holidays. And I, as hard as I've been even raising kids and the fun that I pretended to have with them, it's just a time of year that was always traumatic in my house. There was the drinking. There was always no money. There was always the stress of that hanging over everything we did. My path to addiction was threefold. One, 80% of addicts and alcoholics have comorbid mental health issues, whether it's bipolar disorder, anxiety, whatever. 80% of addicts and alcoholics suffer from some kind of mental illness. Mm. The other thing is trauma. You know, if you've had what the four ACEs, we go through the training as teachers, you learn to recognize trauma in kids. Well, you learn to recognize what I went through. And I had a very traumatic time growing up on so many fronts. There wasn't any physical abuse, but there was a great deal of emotional abuse that went on in my house. And being the youngest, you know, shit rolls downhill. So my dad to my brother to my brother down to me, you know.
Right.
So I got beat up on emotionally a lot. And, you know, the one thing that the first time I drank enough to feel the effects was at my brother Steve's bachelor party. I was 14. I was his best man. He was getting married. We had this bar. It was all my family and his friends. We had this bar open. And I remember drinking enough to where I felt the effects. And it was like my brain slowed down. For the first time, I felt like I could breathe. And I always say, like, you ever watch Star Trek? Are you a Star Trek fan?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, or in Star Wars, when they shut the engine off, it goes,
boom.
Uh-huh.
You
know?
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
What my brain did. And I went, oh, I can breathe. I want more of that.
Mm.
And that's where it starts. And, you know, alcohol is a great, it's the great equalizer, you know, for mental illness, for trauma. It makes everything okay for a while. And if you depend on that too much, you then cross into addiction, which I don't believe I was a full-blown alcoholic, daily drinking kind of guy till I was 19. And I could almost tell you when, you know, September of my freshman year in college, where I started going from having fun to drinking daily. And my trauma, my past, growing up in an alcoholic family, an emotionally abusive alcoholic family, in combined with mental illness, it was pretty much a guarantee that I was at some point going to become dependent on chemicals. Everybody in my family is. I joke around. See my Irish flag back here? You shake the McCann family tree and out falls a bunch of drunk Irishmen. And that's a fact. I go top to bottom. All my cousins, my uncles, my father, were either in rehab, in a program, or actively drinking. And that's the entire family. And I've got several. My brother quit drinking. I don't know if he's in a program. My sister's in a 12-step program. My other brother passed away some years ago of colon cancer and a damaged liver from chronic alcoholism. And it's kind of just what happens to us, whether it's the gene, it's, you know, the mental health thing. My mother had severe mental health issues and some kind of a personality disorder that I've never really been able to put my finger on exactly what her thing was, but she had some kind of a personality disorder and she was a very difficult person. You know, my dad was, of course, you know, he was drunk and then he had the stroke. So he was real quiet and angry. I always said he had three modes, sleeping, pissed, or his grandkids, you know, when I was a teenager, because he really liked his grandkids. It really made him happy. But then as an adult, that all kind of went away. And he was my best friend the day he died. You know, I held that man's hand for 8 days while he died. We were best friends. And I can't say the same as my mother, though. She was abusive till the day she died. My father, however, wasn't. When I turned 18, he respected me. And we had a whole new relationship built on respect and love and kindness. And I always called him the play in three acts. There's the guy when I was a kid, act one, the guy that with the stroke when I was a teenager, and then act three came along when I was an adult. And this was that, you know, the relationship I will remember. My sons, I've discussed that with them, and I'm a play in three acts to them too, you know, with being bipolar and everything else, and the relationship I have with my sons now and my daughter now that they're adults. They've had to come to grips with a lot and deal with their own trauma. And I've helped with that. I've been able to help them with that. And I can only apologize so much. You know what I mean? I'm sorry who I was, but, and it's okay now.
Yeah. And what's another thing that's okay? I've noticed on the groups, people often talk about how they ruin relationships. And I don't say, by the way, in those groups, I just post like about the podcast, or I'll say like, congratulations, because I know like, it's like I've learned to like keep my mouth shut about a lot of stuff unless I post on my own personal page, because somehow whatever I say, even if it's positive in my head, someone will take it wrongly. Because like some people, let's say if they relapse and then they are beating themselves down, I want to say, okay, now you know about it, and now tomorrow you can do better. Or if you're able today, you can do better. It's okay. You know, like that word is okay. It's kind of like, not that it's okay to do it, but it's okay to like fail and you know, that's to get yourself back up, because that's life. And I want to say things like that, but I don't want to say it and then have someone thinking I'm saying it's okay to do it. And you were, you know, all this stuff. So I was just like, not say anything, but I'm very curious. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to talk to many people and people like you to like ask those questions and for answering. So a question I have is, so a lot of people are mentioning what you mentioned, like they say they either got it because of trauma, childhood, or some people I've talked to, they believe it's in their genes. They just like, it's a thing. And so when I have tried those things, because I was like, okay, let me try smoking weed or cigarettes or try coke, whatever, or drink like the dark liquors. And when I was going through my whatever. And so none of these things were appealing to me. And so, because I've seen the commercials, they say it only takes that one time to do it and whatever. Or sometimes you do that one, because I did smoke, that cigarette that's like menthol. And I understand why menthol is very addictive. It was like eating candy, but it's not candy. It was that thing. But still, I was just like, I've experienced it. I don't want this in my life, whatever. Because I can see examples of people. And so are there people, I don't want to say I don't have trauma, but I don't have any mental troubles. And of course, I have trauma, especially the one I found out last year. But they're not running my life. It's not like I wake up every day and I'm like depressed or stressed about it, and it's like running my life. It's just like something I've discovered and I went through it for 10 months and like, okay, I can manage this or fix this, etc. So I'm not addicted to those things, or I guess they didn't have a hold on me because for some reason, maybe the reasons like people do it, like with the trauma or mental illness, or they have addiction in their genes. Like maybe I'm lucky I don't have one of those three things. And like, I don't know why it is, because I'm like, how can I taste something or did something and then it's just like, eh, while others who did it and then they got hooked for years. So it's like, I'm sure there's probably some people who study those things and I'm very curious about it.
Tons of research into that.
So I'm lucked out, I guess.
Yeah, very much. Yeah. You dodged the bullet of addiction. You've got to step up in life for sure.
Yeah, and I have drank the alcohol, and the effect it does that I did like, though, it's like it makes me sleepy. And I'm like, oh, I could use this to go to sleep early. But then knowing what it does to people, and I'm like, no, I don't I don't want to be doing that just so I can go sleep early. Then I'm going to be depending on it. You know, I'm like, no, I can just actually tire myself out. Then I can actually go to sleep early. After a 12-hour day, there's no question about it. I'm going to sleep early. Yeah. So I don't need alcohol.